The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
This is a koan from the Book of Serenity, also called the Book of Equanimity, also called the Record of Going Easy. And this is the version that we encounter in our koan curriculum, case 79 in the Book of Serenity. Changsha takes a step. Changsha had a monk ask Master Wei, "What about before you saw Nanchuan?" Wei sat still for a little while. "What about after seeing him?" "Nothing special." The monk returned and told Changsha this. Changsha said, "The enlightened person sits on the top of a 100-foot pole. She's entered the way, but it is not yet genuine. She must take a step from the top of the pole, and worlds in the 10 directions will be her complete body." The monk asked, "How shall I step from the top of a 100-foot pole?" "Mountains of Long, waters of Li." "I don't understand. Four seas and five lakes are all under the reign of the monarch." So this story may sound familiar to you if you have sat with the koans in the Gateless Gate. It's a different take, a kind of more complete version of a case that we encounter in the Gateless Gate, case 46, which is called Shi Shuang, Step from the Top of the Pole. So this time we don't have a nameless monk, but a priest named Shi Shuang, who says, "How do you step from the top of a 100-foot pole?" It just starts there. We don't get the story about Master Wei. And then it says, another eminent master of former times, namely Changsha, said, "You who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you've entered the way, it is not yet genuine. Take a step from the top of the pole, and the worlds of the 10 directions are your total body." So these are two different translations of the same set of verses that we trace back to Changsha. These aren't two totally different versions of the story. I said that the Book of Serenity version was more complete. Really, they're both complete, but the Book of Serenity gives us more detail. You might wonder why in one version it's the enlightened person sits on top of the 100-foot pole, she has entered the way. And in the other version, it's you who sit on the top of the 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way. And so in classical Chinese, we don't get personal pronouns. And therefore, we can take it various ways. We can take these verses as you who sit, as he who sits, as she who sits, and even as I who sit. And I think that that's the right way to take these. These verses aren't just about someone named Master Wei in ancient China. These verses are about you. These verses are about me. So let's all take them quite personally. Another difference that you might have noticed is between just simply you who sit on top of the 100-foot pole and the enlightened person sits on top of the 100-foot pole. There's a kind of claim there that we don't get in the Gateless Gate. And just leaving you with that for now. We'll come back around to that. But I want to say something about this exchange that starts the koan in the Book of Serenity. Changsha had a monk ask Master Wei. This is a situation we encounter in several koans, where one teacher sends a student, a practitioner, to visit another, maybe to learn something from the other teacher, maybe to check the other teacher out. And so Changsha had a monk visit Master Wei and ask, what about before you saw Nanchuan? What about before you encountered this great teacher? What about you before you encountered this great teaching in its most pressing form, the form that a great teacher like Nanchuan would present it in? And Wei sat still for a little while. My comment would be, so far, so good. What about after seeing him? Nothing special. This is an interesting moment in the koan because it can be taken in very different ways. Nothing special. Is that Master Wei stepping off the pole, or is that Master Wei stuck on the pole? Different translators and commentators seem to be on two different sides of this, two different minds on this. Another translation of nothing special is there couldn't be anything else. And in the case of there couldn't be anything else, it doesn't sound quite as promising as nothing special. We use the phrase nothing special in Zen a fair amount of the time. Nothing special. What is enlightenment? Nothing special. What is this practice? Nothing special. What did Weka, the second ancestor, Chinese ancestor, receive from Bodhidharma? We might say nothing special. But there couldn't be anything else. It seems different. That seems to be more of a statement about emptiness. And Wan Song says in his commentary, Wan Song is the editor of the Book of Serenity. I say, once dead, he did not revive. That doesn't sound so great either, although we could take that two ways. And later, Wan Song has specific comments on each line. And his comment on the line, there couldn't be anything else, Wan Song says, he stumbled and fell into a pile of shit. Now, that too could be taken two ways. Maybe that's exactly what should happen to us, is maybe we need to stumble and fall into a pile of shit. And that would be a cause for great rejoicing. But it could also just be he got stuck in the shit. He got stuck in the mire. So what I hope I'm conveying to you is that this is not a transparent koan in any way. This is a difficult koan, and it keeps us sitting with us with it. We may sit with this koan for a long time when we study koan by koan through the koan curriculum. Maybe not. Maybe we get it right away. Everyone's path is different, and I think that that's important to keep in mind. That each path is different. This koan is not giving us detailed instructions on what we need to do, but it is giving us a hint about where we shouldn't get fixated. So here's Changsha's verse again. The enlightened person, or you, sits at the top of the 100-foot pole. She's entered the way, but is not yet genuine. Or although you've entered the way, it is not yet genuine. So what does it mean to be at the top of a pole? What does that convey to us? And I think this is a place where we may not give the koan enough time and enough credit. This being on top of a 100-foot pole. When I was a kid, I don't see these so much anymore. So I'm going to explain something that maybe you all know perfectly well what I'm talking about. But when I was a kid, many playgrounds and school playgrounds had a tetherball pole. And this was a tall metal pole. And at the top, there was a little hook. And attached to the hook was a rope. And at the end of the rope was a ball like a soccer ball, except it had a cleat on the top so that you could tie the rope to it or tether it to the pole. So this is why it was tetherball. There was a ball tethered to this pole, and you and your playmate would be on each side of the pole, equidistant, and you would slap the ball one way and your friend would slap it the other way, and you would try to be the one to get the rope wrapped all the way around the pole, and then you'd win. So I really liked tetherball. I thought it was a really fun game, but I also liked the pole itself, independent of the ball and the rope. And sometimes you would encounter a tetherball pole that didn't have a rope on it because these ropes would fray and the balls would bounce away or they would be taken down for the winner or whatever. And as a child, when I would see one of these tetherball poles, I really wanted to climb up it. I was very attracted to this. This was a favorite game or exercise of mine as a child. I was a skinny kid, and that was often a disadvantage in games and exercises. But for climbing the pole, it wasn't such a disadvantage because I had less weight to pull up. And so, hand over hand, and my calves and thighs clinging to the pole, I can still feel it in my body, this effort of climbing up the pole. And I have no idea if I had to try many times to get to the top of the pole or not. I don't remember this long period of arduous attempts to climb the pole. I do know that it took some application, or what we call in Zen, great determination. I know I was determined to do it. I don't remember if I got finally to the top of the pole after many, many attempts in a single season, or if one year I came back to the pole and I had gotten a little bigger and a little stronger and I just shinnied right up it. I have no idea. I would like to have a dramatic story to tell you, but I don't. But I do know that I eventually did get to the top of the pole. And what a wonderful experience that was. And then after that, there was a phase that I'm happy to tell you this did not last into adulthood, but there was a phase when I would just, run for the pole when I saw it and get right up onto the top of it. And I liked to be seen at the top of the pole, and I liked to see from the top of the pole. I liked this different perspective that you got when you were above it all, and this feeling of accomplishment. So this climbing a pole, not unique to me and not unique to post-World War II US and its brief tetherball fascination, but pole climbing featured for centuries in village fairs, often a greased pole. You may have heard of the greased pole, and as part of the games of the village fair, the village youths would compete with each other to try to shinny up this greased pole and get to the top of it. And climbing poles and ropes have played a role in military training over the past centuries. I don't know how far back it goes, really. If you saw the animated Disney movie about Mulan, then you know that at least the Disney people think or pretend that this goes back to ancient China. I saw this movie, not ancient China, but medieval China. I saw this movie when my kids were little with my kids, and there's a scene where Mulan, after many, many attempts and failures, spends all night getting to the top of some tall wooden pole. And then looks down, and the sun rises, and there's Mulan at the top of the pole, looking down at the camp. Her relationship to the camp and to her training has changed now. So getting to the top of the pole means something has changed, something's happened. And now that might sound like I'm getting pretty far from our koan, but I'm not so sure. I think that getting to the top of the pole means something has changed in our koan as well. The enlightened person sits on top of the 100-foot pole. This version implies that this is a state of having had an enlightenment experience, Now you're at the top of this 100-foot pole after your months or years of great determination, of great effort. There you are. The enlightened person sits on top of the 100-foot pole. The other version, right, just a little bit more open-ended, you who sit on the top of the 100-foot pole. One translator of the Book of Serenity says, well, we're all always on top of some kind of pole, says that more or less. We're always on top of a pole. I think maybe that's true in some sense, and not a great approach to this koan. But I also think to limit it to, well, when you've had a enlightenment experience, you're finally at the top of the pole, is maybe too exclusive. So these two approaches, I think one is too universal and one is too particular, too exclusive. And I would suggest that not the enlightened person sits on top of the 100-foot pole, but and this would not make a good translation, but this is how I understand it. The person who's had a certain kind of experience finds themselves at the top of a 100-foot pole, or sits at the top of a 100-foot pole. The person who's had a certain kind of experience. What kind of experience is this? What kind of experience leaves you or brings you to the top of a 100-foot pole? And one shortcut way of saying this would be, well, some kind of Kensho experience. A Kensho experience isn't necessarily, right, an all-out, full realization enlightenment experience. There are greater and lesser Kensho experiences, but all of them are breakthroughs of a kind, are breakthrough experiences. In some Zen schools over the centuries and right now, to pass the Mu Koan is to have a Kensho experience. Without a Kensho experience, some teachers would say you have not passed the Mu Koan. Maybe not. That's not exactly the way that we do it. Although you could say that any breakthrough, again, is a kind of Kensho. There are larger and smaller Kensho experiences. There are also experiences that we might not want to call that, but that also might be top of the pole experiences. There are experiences of non-separation, of great intimacy with whatever is arising. There are experiences of everything falling away. And we read a couple of versions that describe experiences that alter things, that change one's relationship to the self and to the world. And one is from China, from Hongzhi, who was the original compiler of the Book of Serenity, by the way, although not the editor was Wan Song, but Hongzhi put those 100 together, chose them, and put them in that order. And in the field of boundless emptiness, Hongzhi tells us, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. That is, he's introducing the experience of something that's always been there. We might say of the original face, of original mind. What is your original face before your parents were born? What exists from the very beginning? You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you fabricated into apparent habits. There's that great determination. Why do we sit sesshins together? Maybe it has something to do with this grinding down, this brushing away. Sometimes it's a grinding down, sometimes it's just a brushing away of all these tendencies that I like the translation here of apparent habits. Maybe these aren't such deep-seated, inescapable habits as we think they are. And then he tells us something about I would say what it's like at the top of the 100-foot pole. Upright independence does not rely upon anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. Accordingly, we're told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. Each speck of dust, every form, everything we encounter, everything that arises, and now an ability to respond to that without becoming attached, without becoming its partner, without becoming stuck. Our other reading was from an equally great teacher, this one in Japan, a great teacher, Hakuin. Interesting too that Hangzhe is an important figure in the Soto or in China Shaodong tradition, and Hakuin is an equally important figure in the Rinzai tradition. And it was Hakuin who made the basis of our koan curriculum that we use to this day in Boundless Way Zen. So Hakuin in Great Doubt, it's a little bit more dramatic. And I'm not saying this is the same experience that Hangzhe is talking about. This is another take on what it's like to get to and be on top of the 100-foot pole. When a person faces great doubt, I mentioned great determination, one of the three pillars of Zen. The other two are great faith and great doubt. When a person faces great doubt before them, there is in all directions only a vast and empty land without birth and without death, like a huge plain of ice extending in all directions. This sounds like a really fanciful metaphor, but maybe this is an experience that one can have, where the entire visible universe, the entire field, is like brittle ice or brittle glass that could shatter at any moment. There's really two phases in this. That's the first phase, facing great doubt. When a person faces great doubt, there's before them in all directions only a vast and empty land without birth and without death, like a huge plain of ice extending in all directions. Penetrating it, that's the second phase, is trampling the multi-tiered gate of birth and death. Again, birth and death do not appear. The multi-tiered gate of birth and death, and has come down through endless kalpas. It is penetrating the inner understanding and basic enlightenment of all the Tathagatas. This second phase is what we would refer to as Satori or enlightenment. But you must accept that the realization of so felicitous a thing as the great matter will involve a certain amount of suffering. Hangzhe doesn't talk about the suffering, although there is that grinding down, which sounds a bit unpleasant. But maybe the suffering has to do with this sense of being in a vast and empty land, this sense of loss, of utter emptiness. So these are different ways of talking about, I would say, what it's like to be on top of a 100-foot pole. Not a problem to be on top of a 100-foot pole. Not a mistake, but part of what happens when you practice Zen sincerely with your whole heart, and you practice it with great faith and great doubt and great determination, and you give everything to it. But this isn't where you want to live. You don't want to live on top of a pole. If as a child I had stayed on top of the tetherball pole, I would have starved to death and I would not be talking to you now. Tempting as it was, nice as it was, up on top of the pole, there was a time to come down. There was a time to let go of that sense of being above it all, to let go of that sense of, look at me, here I am. Look what I've accomplished. And that is a danger in Zen. That is a danger in being on top of the pole. This sense that now you are in a place of absolute freedom. Maybe that's not the place of absolute freedom, or maybe that's not a kind of freedom that we want to have. So Changsha gives a kind of instruction. Could be a commentary on what happened with Master Wei, or it could be an instruction to the monk. The enlightened person sits on top of a 100-foot pole. She's entered the way, but it is not yet but is not yet genuine. Or although you've entered the way, it is not yet genuine. That's really interesting, right? So you would think enlightenment was it. That's now we're done. And now Changsha says, no, that's entering the way. This is something that the kind of thing that Dogen likes to say, right? Although you've had this experience and this experience and this experience, you're just playing in the entrance way. You're just playing at the threshold. She's entered the way, but it's not yet genuine. She must take a step from the top of the pole. And maybe that is the kernel of this koan, the wado, going back to how do you step from the top of a 100-foot pole? What does this mean? She must take a step from the top of the pole, and worlds in the 10 directions will be her complete body. What does that suggest to you? What does it mean for worlds in all the 10 directions, the four cardinal directions, the four directions between them, like southeast and northwest, up and down, for the worlds in the 10 directions? What does it mean for those worlds to be your complete body? What would that be like? What would that feel like? What would you do next? And the monk asks, and here's that question, how shall I step from the top of a 100-foot pole? Mountains of Long, waters of Li. I love this poetic moment in the koan. Mountains of Long, waters of Li. I don't understand. Right. Pretty cryptic. Four seas and five lakes are all under the reign of the monarch. Or we might say under the reign of the emperor. What monarch are we talking about? Who's this emperor who suddenly enters the metal landscape of this koan? Whose reign is this? What does this have to do with the worlds in the 10 directions being someone's complete body? Wonderful prompts that this koan sets for us. And we don't want to go through it too quickly. We don't want this particular koan, even though it's in the record of going easy, to be too easy. We want to stay with this one. We want to let this one puzzle us and maybe even turn us inside out a little bit. We want it to encourage us to have the kind of experience represented by the top of the 100-foot pole, and to not cling to it the way one might cling to the top of a 100-foot pole if one found oneself up there. If one shinnied all the way up. I want to say something else about the kinds of experiences that this koan points towards in its earlier sections, the sitting at the top of a 100-foot pole. I mentioned that we might call these Kensho experiences, and in some schools of Zen, including some that are active right now, there's a fairly and to me strangely precise idea about what Kensho is and what it means to have a Kensho experience, what they look like, what they feel like, how you know them, how you attain them, and lots and lots of emphasis on this in certain Zen groups, some of them, at least one of them, quite closely related to ours, more than one really that I can think of. We don't do this in Boundless Way Zen, but I just want you to know that this is done. And again, I think that that is pushes too much towards a kind of one size fits all Zen, and that is not our Zen in Boundless Way. In fact, our way is boundless. That would include no one size fits all instructions or experiences or paths. Each of us will find our own pathway. And so I suggested that a certain kind of experience is closer to my understanding, and not always one that we might want to call a Kensho experience. But there are experiences that change everything. And I want to emphasize that there are experiences that give us a lot of confidence in the way that make us feel that this is not just words, that there really are these possibilities for experiencing ourselves in the world in different ways than we have before. And again, we don't want to cling to them. And maybe when I put it in that kind of open-ended way, it would be right to say we've all had these experiences. David Roshi likes to say this, and I believe that he's correct, and it's very encouraging when he does. And it's also just true. You don't want to be the person that says, "Oh, well, not me. I've never had that. I've never had any kind of experience like being on top of a 100-foot pole. Nothing like that ever happened to me." No, we don't want to be too modest. We don't want to be the worst Zen student on the screen or in the Zendo. On the other hand, not every experience changes everything for you. Not every experience is a radical experience of the world changing in ways that are unexpected and are irreversible. And not every experience changes one's relationship to oneself in ways that are completely unexpected and irreversible. So there are these experiences on offer. There are these experiences that have, from the beginning, been associated with the Zen way, back to Bodhidharma and all the way forward. And of course, back to the Buddha. All the way back, and we could trace this through all of the centuries of Buddhism, but particularly in the Chan and Zen traditions in China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, America, this tradition that really emphasizes these experiences and that says that you don't need another lifetime to have them. That they are, as I said, they're on offer. They're available in this lifetime. They're available at this sesshin. This is not something that you should think of as far away or limited to special people or to special circumstances. Our true nature is right here all the time. That original mind that Hangzhi was pointing towards. The field of boundless emptiness that's been here from the beginning. It has been here from the beginning, and it's here right now. It's palpable right now. Maybe you can feel it. So, Book of Serenity, case 79, Changsha takes a step. Changsha had a monk ask Master Wei, "What about before you saw Nanchuan?" Wei sat still for a little while. "What about after seeing him?" "Nothing special." The monk returned and told Changsha this. Changsha said, "The enlightened person sits on the top of a 100-foot pole. She's entered the way, but is not yet genuine. She must take a step from the top of the pole, and worlds in the 10 directions will be her complete body. The monk asked, "How shall I step from the top of a 100-foot pole? Mountains of long, waters of li. I don't understand. Four seas and five lakes are all under the reign of the monarch." Thank you. So please sit comfortably and let's enter into Dharma dialogue together, and inviting you to come forward with whatever is arising for you, whether it was something that came for to you during the talk or not. Doesn't have to be in any explicit way related to anything I've said. Just come forward from where you are right now. And we already have a couple of Zoom hands up. So yes, please raise your Zoom hand when you're ready to speak, and let's start with Annie.
Thank you, Alan, for your talk. I would like you to repeat, mountains are long, and I didn't get what water was. I'm sorry, I just couldn't quite catch it. So,
Yeah, mountains of long, waters of li, L-I, waters of li.
L-I.
Yeah, it's just a
Oh.
place. Long and li are places.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, not L-O-N-G, L-A-N-G. Capital
Right.
L, capital L.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the next line was.
I don't understand. Four seas and five lakes are all under the reign of the monarch. Yeah.
Okay.
So what are your mountains of long, Annie?
Ah, well, my mount out of my room that I'm sitting in now, my bedroom, I can see the mountains of Areri, which are Snowdonia.
Yeah.
So I suppose they're my mountains, but and
Yeah, beautiful.
the waters of Lee are the pond down the garden.
Yeah.
Will that do?
That's all you need to say.
Thank you.
Thanks, Annie. Also inviting Paul and Michael to join me in responding. Joanne.
Thank you. That was beautiful. Now I'm just going to see you on top of a pole for the rest of my life. I really connected with this, and so many things are sort of bubbling up. Including the five remembrances, the deeds being my closest companions, and just this journey up the pole, practice, showing up, sort of staying in a way, or even when you don't feel like you're staying. And this realm of the discursive figuring out mind that just, reaches a point where it's like, oh, wait, no, like it isn't even possible. Like, which also makes me think of, mountains and river, mountains are mountains, rivers are rivers, and then they're not.
Right.
And then when they are, again, it's it just opens up everything. And yet the you're still like you still have you're still just alive. It's like nothing has actually changed per se. And the five remembrances of your deeds, like, and actions, like those, you don't just finish the all your deeds today. Or, oh, I did all my deeds a half hour ago. No, you're still alive and here. And I just love that. I haven't heard that koan being talked about literally in years. That was nice. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Joanne. And everything you said is quite relevant, and I'm appreciating all of it. And I want to emphasize what you said at the end, which is, you're not done with your deeds. Like, okay, well, now that's done. Done all those deeds. Now I can just stay at top of the pole. And that's a temptation. And that's a huge problem when one falls into that temptation. And just as one's deeds never stop, one's practice never stops. And so the idea, I had a friend who was involved with a Zen teacher in Europe who was not a good person. And more, the more I heard about this person, the more suspicious I became and kind of protective for my friend. And he told my friend once that she didn't need to do Zazen anymore because she'd had this certain experience. And I said, no. That's not Soto Zen. This guy was a Soto Zen's teacher, and I said, no, it's practice enlightenment. Even if you had this experience, which I think he was flattering her, he later stole 50,000 euros from her, so I think he was flattering her. But even if you had this experience, you keep practicing. It doesn't end, and otherwise, right? You are stuck on top of the pole. So, yeah, great reminder. Thank you, Joanne. Marla.
Thank you, Alan. I enjoyed that talk. It made me think that every time I've had a peak experience, from maybe a koan answer to, like, I translated that, or I wrote that, I played that, it ends anyway. If I wanted to stay up there in the high of I ran up the hill and there's an eagle, it's going to change anyway. And now I'm starting to wonder if that whole mentality of, like, I got it, is where you start sliding back down the pole. I did it. Well, and with the hands off, you just start going down. So maybe that's lucky. That's lucky. If we wanted to live at the top of the 100-foot pole, perhaps that's not our choice to make anyway. I don't know. But this has been very fruitful thinking. Thank you.
Yeah, and I just want to say, you said sliding down the pole, but this is about stepping from the pole, and I think that those are two different things. And you're talking about sliding back down the pole. But the koan is inviting us to step from the pole, and I'm not going to say anything more. I just want to invite you to
You're correct. You're correct. I'm thinking of the person tripping and falling themselves off and not intentionally or stepping in a practice consistent way. That's well put comment.
Marla, I appreciate you mentioning this. There's a reason, I believe, in especially in Boundless Way, that you don't hear teachers talking about their personal enlightenment experiences. And because that sort of experience, to you're talking about a dream. You're essentially referring to something that's objectified. And so that you just can't say really anything about it. And so it's everything is more of a pointer. And so anytime we feel like, oh, I made it to the top of the 100-foot pole and then I slid down and then I'm back up again, those are nice narratives that we could probably entertain in our minds for a while, but they aren't it. And that's why we come back to practice. Like Alan said, we're never done. We're never done.
Thanks, Marla. Anne, L.
Once again, my brain gets stuck on details. The first few lines were talking about visiting a famous teacher whose name I can't remember. And the original question of where were you before and after was before and after seeing that teacher. And you switched it to before and after being on top of the pole, which almost equates the t seeing the teacher and being on top of the pole. And what does that mean?
Yeah, I don't think that's exactly what I did, but let's see if we can sort this out. Yeah, so Changsha is the great teacher. Master Wei, maybe, maybe not. We don't know anything about Master Wei. He might be a great teacher, he might not be such a great teacher, but he is a Zen teacher. So Changsha has a monk ask Master Wei. So it's Master Wei And so Master Wei is asked, what about before you saw Nan Chuan? What about after seeing him? And Wei's answers are sitting still and then saying nothing special, or in another translation, saying there couldn't be anything else. And
What does
so
that have to
then,
do with the poem?
sorry.
What does all that have to do with the poem? Why
So
does it
then,
start?
that's Changsha's comment on what the monk has told him about this interview. And so it's Changsha that suggests that, and we can take this two ways, right? Changsha either says, right, Wei was on top of the pole and then Wei stepped off it, and that was nothing special. Or he could say, Wei got to the top of the 100-foot pole after he met Nan Chuan and is stuck there. And that would be more the once dead, he did not revive. That's Wan Song's comment. That would go more with there couldn't be anything else. And we don't know. And I'm not taking a stand either way. I just want it to out there that there are two ways to understand Changsha's understanding of Master Wei. So yeah, it's a little bit like Russian dolls, right? We've got experiences within experiences within the koan, and I think maybe now we're all a little confused, which is good.
Okay.
Inviting Paul or Michael to add something if they want. No,
Yeah.
okay. Oh, Paul.
No. And I love this aspect of being caught up in the details. You said, once again, and you almost said it as an apology. Once again, my mind gets caught up in the details. Get caught. And notice. How you're caught. This koan, yes, it's about this teacher and this monk and the experience. And just as Alan was saying in his talk, it's really an invitation for each of us to see where where we get caught to use your language, or in this case, the practice which each of us apparently has come to our own and said this is a requirement. This practice of climbing that pole, and then the practice of stepping off of it. So my encouragement to you is to not apologize for the stuck places, not to seek answers from it from any of us, but to find out for yourself. Keep climbing that pole. Keep stepping off of it.
Thanks, Anne. David. David L.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Alan, for the talk. One of the things you said in passing was about great faith. Wasn't really part of this koan, but this comes up a lot, and I struggle so much with this part of practice, this great faith. I think great doubt is something that just kind of arises very spontaneously and easily, but great faith often does not. And this kind of, I wasn't thinking about this until you mentioned this story about this teacher in Europe who was stealing money and all this stuff, but it reminded me of something that comes often too, and it's this feeling of, I don't know how to explain this, but it's the sometimes the actions don't necessarily correlate with how we feel like it should be in some way. Like there's a story of the Buddha, and he didn't want women to be ordained. Like he wouldn't allow women to, and he's this, I remember hearing this story of all these women coming and kind of insisting to be ordained, and they traveled like thousands of miles. And it was Ananda that convinced him to let the women be ordained. And Ananda was the one who didn't have an enlightenment experience. Ananda until after the Buddha had died. And so I remember when I heard this story, it was at this foundations class I was taking through the New York Zen Center, and they were talking about this story. And the way it was described was that the it was this was kind of like a sign of the times, like this was how it was back then. And I didn't like that answer. I didn't like that. I like it, and to me, it was no. It was not a sign of the times. Like the Buddha just got it wrong. Like Ananda got it right there.
Yeah.
And like and so
I'm going to step in now, Dave, and say, right, we don't want to set up even the Buddha as always having been right, right? And in the Zen tradition, right, we're told, Linji says this, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha, right? If you meet this all perfect, wonderful being, then kill that that illusion right away. And you know the thing about Ananda, we're working with different timelines. In the Zen tradition, Ananda has his awakening experience after the Buddha died, but it's not clear that in the early sutras that that's the case. And it's in the early sutras that the story is told about the women coming to Buddha. And you know, in our version, it's more Mahaprajapati, the Buddha's stepmother, that convinces him. So, you know, there's a bunch of different stories that are being superimposed here. But I want to go back to where you started with great doubt and great faith, and suggest that, you know, there's doubt and there's great doubt, and great doubt is what is talked about in the reading that we did today. That's a little different than the kind of doubt that comes up around, you know, around the stories you just told. Great doubt is different from that kind of doubt. Both are important in Zen. And you said that you had a problem with great faith. And again, great faith is not like ordinary faith. It's not, I believe this because the Buddha said it. It's not, I believe this because my teacher said it. Great faith is, I believe it because I've touched it in some way. I believe it because my experiences are leading me to believe it. A teacher who's no longer with us, and I don't mean is dead, but it sounds that way. Teacher who's no longer with us said, it's like no one says that they have faith in gravity, and yet we do have faith that we're not going to just suddenly drift off the face of the earth, and that faith is like that. Is like this faith that we have in gravity when we dare to step out of our houses and don't worry that we'll rise like a helium balloon into the sky and disappear.
And just touch on what Alan said too. The word faith has a lot of different meanings, especially when you consider faith-based religions, right? This is not what Zen is. Zen, the faith in Zen is not belief without evidence. There's a faith that's, as we say, knowing for yourself when water is cool or warm when you drink it. You know you've just taken in breath and there's an out breath until there's nothing. There's not. So that this faith in the flow of life that is constantly present and constantly with you, this is the faith that Zen points to.
Thank you, Dave. Eva.
Thank you very much, Alan, for your talk. I find words both clarifying and utterly confusing. So I'm left between the two, really. The invitation to step back from the pole was what spoke to me most. And it reminded me of two
Step off,
things.
Ava.
Step off. Step off the pole. It reminded me of the Paul Simon songs, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. You know, like something that seems utterly impossible, and yet there are countless ways of doing it. You just need to do it. Many years ago, I did a parachute jump, and you have to stand on the wing for a while before you jump off. And while you're standing on the wing, it just feels like there's no way I could get off. But actually, once you're off, it's easy. But it struck me as a quite a masculine image or metaphor, this climbing the pole. Not to say that that's male, because we all have the masculine and feminine, and I wouldn't in any way want to qualify whatever experiences I may have had, but I find any sense of oneness realization, I find I have to live it. And so it's almost like, the Olympic mountain where you can't get the flame, but then you have to take it round. And so whatever sense of oneness I might have in my practice, I have to put it into practice. I have to integrate it in my life. And that's what I find the most difficult thing, actually. I have to keep on going from clarity to confusion and falling back and
Yeah.
yeah.
And in this case, you have to do it without a parachute.
Yes.
Thank you, Ava. So we'll have three more comments and encouraging you to keep them short because we've already taken a lot of our morning's time, but there is time to hear from three more people. So, Jonathan. Unmuting, Jonathan.
There we go. Okay. I know this tether ball pole. I remember those. And when I was smaller, my hands would have a hard time holding onto the pole because it was a little bigger than my hands were. And it'd be very hot in the summertime and very cold in the wintertime. And climbing the pole, I know I kind of see this as a metaphor for my practice. It's a lot of work to get up there. It's like constant effort. You just keep going up and you slip back and you don't have the strength and you just keep trying and you keep trying. And if you do get to the top, well, it takes a lot of effort to stay there. And then goodness knows if you actually get up, so you're standing on top of the pole. That sounds real. I mean, I never did that as a kid with a tetherball pole, but that sounds really precarious. And that, I don't know, it's and the final thing, stepping off. There's one of our readings has a line, something along the, it has a phrase in it about letting go and attaining stability, which I think I get it, but it's also simultaneously terrifying. I mean, that letting go, stepping out into the void, if you will. I don't know. It just that's kind of where I went with this poll and and your discussion.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. I love the physicality of your memories. I share them exactly. I remember the cold feeling in my hands, and I remember the hot, especially as my legs were wrapped around the pole and the heat kind of burning into them. Michael or Paul?
I would just add to the problem with a metaphor like this is it can assume like, well, there's a 100-foot pole and I've only gone 20 feet, or I've gotten, now I'm going 25 and tomorrow it'll be 30. So I would say that you are closer to the top of the pole than you think, and that what you think is an quite possibly are actually an impediment to getting to the top of the pole. So this is about practice and not trying to engineer a way, just find some way of getting a ladder and climbing up. This is about practice continuous and yeah, each moment.
Thank you, Jonathan. Chad.
Thank you for the talk. Yeah, I had this little narrative that my mind was feeling as you were talking. And it's like great determination of, working hard at something or really trying to practice and then getting to the top of the pole. And there's that moment of like, here I am. And then it's now what? And then this aspect of great fear of, holy cow, I have to get down again and take that step off. But as I'm looking around, the vision of, hills and mountains and valleys. It's just like, wow, there's so much more out there, right? And it just continues. The faith for me is knowing that this is the cycle. This is it. Right here, I'll get down, I'll do it again, I'll be scared, I'll find something new, but I'll still relish that beauty.
Yeah, thank you. Wonderfully said. And also, what you brought out for me too is that view from the top of the pole, there's a separation there. You're l looking at the prospect, but you're not in the prospect. And I think that that's important for us all to keep in mind in relation to this koan and in relation to our practice.
Yeah, I would also like to just add this aspect of fear, and I appreciate this kind of strong emotion pairing up. And as a in my day job or my former day job, I was a psychologist, and we would often talk about these two fears: fear of success, fear of failure. Don't need to get into the specifics of it, other than the aspect that I think each of them can have us close down. So I don't want to go up that pole, never taking that step in this case for us to engage into practice. I don't want to get off that because I don't want to lose this. I'm so attached to this. That type of fear. Again, it really keeps us from engaging in our life. And our practice is very simple, just as Michael was saying, and as Alan has been demonstrating again and again. It's just this. It's just this. This is the 24/7 practice of Zazen. It's just this. It's just this.
Thanks, Chad. And finally, either Corwin or Aaron.
Yeah, I appreciated that usually when I have heard this before about stepping off the pole, I've imagined it as being something totally terrifying and disorienting, and yeah, I think it can be that. I felt like listening to this talk, I also felt like it could be entering like the mud of your life, I guess, too. So I appreciate that different perspective.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. And that's what I liked about Wan Song's comment that he stumbled and fell into a pile of shit. It could be that Wan Song Master Wei really blew it, or it could be that Master Wei had that experience of entering the mud and water of his life, of re-entering the mud and water of his life. So another great connection for us to make, that the lotus ultimately needs muddy water, not clear water, to bloom in, and our practice grows out of the mud and water of our lives, which is very relevant to our disentangled bell sesshin, where we go back and forth between practicing together, doing these ancient forms and not so ancient forms, and then back to the mud and water of our lives. So, thanking everyone and leaving you with that.